Progressive Radio Network. Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Peter Breggin. I'm glad to be with you again today. And I have one of my favorite guests on, whom we'll hear from in a minute or two. Gina, are you there? Let me check in with you first.
Yes. Hi, Peter.
Oh, I'm so glad you're there. Well, before I get to a bright spot, let me go to a introductory dark spot. Suicide rates continue to go up in the United States at a rapid rate. They're going up for all ages. Excuse me a minute. They're going up for all ages, except for people over 72. Particularly hard hit are white middle class Americans in the ages 34 into their 60s, as a new class of being especially hard hit. African Americans living in poverty are hard hit. Native Americans living in poverty are hard hit. I have two thoughts about this that I want to share with you about the rising suicide rate. One is that it's obviously driven in a large part by economics. We have vast numbers of people who are now not even seeking employment. I think the rates are amounts up to about 95 million, which is just way beyond what we usually have. More people describe themselves as living at home with their parents up to the age of 35 than ever before. Older folks who have children don't see their kids as progressing as well into the future as they did. So things are not good economically in the country, and suicide rates always go up during periods of time like that. Now, I want to make two observations about this that you might not ordinarily think about. One, does this indicate a biochemical imbalance for suicide and depression? I mean, it's really quite ridiculous. Depression is a personal psychological response to circumstances, sometimes deep in the past, when people have been badly abused, neglected, rejected, sometimes to the future as they foresee it. It's about hopelessness, hopeless feelings. It's not about biology. The second thing is, when you have a drug that has, and a series of drugs and dozens of drugs that are supposed to address a disease, in this case, supposedly the disease of depression, we've all seen these drugs on TV. And then you have not only those drugs, the regular antidepressants, then you get the antipsychotic drugs disguised as mood stabilizers given as adjuncts to the antidepressants to give them a little more punch by punching you, basically, and subduing you. Well, if you have all these drugs out, why is the suicide rate going up? As others, including people within the establishment, have observed, generally, when you have a treatment that's working, the rates go down. And here we have treatments that are flooding the society and the rates of suicide are going up. Now, certainly this indicates that the drugs don't work. They're not having any kind of epidemiological impact on rising rates, but could they also be causative? Could they be causing the suicide rate? Well, we know about all the antidepressants that they don't work. You've heard on my show, one of the great experts in the field, Irving Kirsch, talking about his studies showing the antidepressants don't work. Not if you look at all the studies instead of the cherry-picked ones. And I already said way back in 94 in a book that I wrote with Ginger Breggin that we knew that Prozac didn't work. The FDA just had to manipulate studies to get it to look like it would work for two of the many. None of them really worked. And the only two they could get that sort of worked were illegal because they had patients on benzos and sedatives to control the agitation, anxiety, and insomnia, which they weren't supposed to do. So the drug really didn't work at all. In fact, it caused problems. Now, if you compare the fact that the antidepressants don't work to the huge list of admitted adverse reactions, this huge list in the government's own FDA-approved full prescribing informations for all the drugs, you're looking at something that doesn't work and causes untold misery. In addition, and I document a lot of this in psychiatric drug withdrawal, in addition, and I also in my book about that deals a lot with suicide, Medication Madness, where I give case after the case of suicide violence from the antidepressants. If you look at this situation, then you look at epidemiological studies that I cite out of Britain and elsewhere showing these drugs cause suicide. You've unleashed on a society that is struggling. We have a society that is struggling, and we have unleashed upon it a plague of neurotoxins that encourage suicide. And now, of course, even the mood stabilizers that are related to the seizure drugs have suicide warnings on them. Every way you turn. And any of us who have worked for decades with the antipsychotic drugs know they cause depression and suicidal behavior. And if you get akathisia from them, you can really get suicidal. And these drugs include all those masquerading drugs like Abilify and Seroquel that are being given out for depression and Seroquel for sleep and so on. So, folks, we're in a situation where a country that is increasingly stressed has an increasing suicide rate, as expected in times of economic difficulty, on top of it being flooded with neurotoxins that cause suicide. It's a grim situation. The press simply refuses to address the situation with the flooding of our society with the antidepressants. So with that grim picture, I want to introduce you to my friend, Gina Nickel, who is the wife, and her husband would say the brain trust, of Bob Nickel, who is another friend who has been on this show, and together they've been on the show several times. And it's not just because they're my friends. It's because Gina is president and CEO of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health, which I and many others, including Bob Whitaker, who was instrumental in starting it, believe is one of the great hopes for our broad field of my wonderful listeners in mental health, psychology, psychiatry, medicine, education, all the child services and interested people who are victims of psychiatry, all of you, here is one of the great hopes. And Gina is just a remarkable individual. And I've asked her to come on the show again to talk about some of the latest innovations in the field that she is supporting through the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health. Hi, Gina Nickel.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Okay. That was a pretty shaking intro I gave, wasn't it? Oh, my God.
Well, I guess I guess it doesn't shake me anymore because here's it. People have to understand, Peter, that what you just described, it is the truth. We need to all get over our fear of what is happening and stand up and pay attention and join together. That's exactly why the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care was created. And in fact, many people, we're a community foundation, many people have funds within us. We're like a community mental health development bank, including the Empathic Fund. People can donate to any fund, but the reason we were created is because we are tired of the news about suicide, about reading and experiencing firsthand with family, friends, all the things that are happening with all these psychotropic medications, the side effects. And we have been, you've been saying this for years and years and years, Peter, and I think finally there's a group of people that have caught up and said, now we have to be stronger and now we have to do something about this. And not in a militant sort of way, but in a way where we can join together and pool our funds and actually fund research program and education that underscore how dangerous these medications are.
Well, I'm so glad you're there. I'm so glad you're doing all of this. Lately, that Gina, and by the way, Nickel, her last name is N-I-K-K-E-L, but you can find her through Gina Nickel or Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. I have been getting in my own mind as I'm working on a new book, just more and more certain that we've got to describe psychiatry for what it is. And I'm not trying to pull you into agreeing with me here, but more and more it's getting clear that since its inception, psychiatry has been a scourge rather than a contributing force to humanity. The whole history of it, going back to the state mental hospitals, which were houses of horrible abuse, continue to be on a much smaller scale because they just threw all the patients out to get them off the hands of the state and get them on federal SSI. And, you know, in the 30s, it reaches a peak of assaults on the brain with lobotomy, which is still somewhat with us, even though my campaign in the 70s stopped most of it. We have electroshock still with us. So many of us now are criticizing that, and the FDA just defies reason, logic, and huge amounts of information recently approves it for depression. It grandfathers it in without any research, without any clinical trials to show its efficacy. And
so
now,
Peter, can I push back?
Go ahead.
Can I push back on you just a little bit?
Oh, yes, what? Push back. Stop me before I just get too extreme.
What you say is absolutely true. There's no doubt about it. But I would surmise that, and this has been my experience, I have met several psychiatrists, such as yourself, and others, social workers, therapists, etc., that have gone into the mental health field for the right reasons. They want to be of help. I think one of our problems is that we don't have a large enough training pool at med schools. As you know, the pharmaceutical companies have a lot of money and a lot of lobbying power. So I'm seeing some hope in some of our younger psychiatrists. They're starting to question the medication-only regimens. So I think what you're saying is absolutely true. But if we can go back to the times before the medication scourge hit us, and the time where there was truly a respite care and sanctuary and helping people get better. I think there's a whole lot of psychiatrists and a whole lot of helpers that really want to get back to that. They're just not sure how, because of the insurance system that we have that pays for 15-minute med checks and 50-minute hours once a week. And that's not what people need. People need relationship. They need hope. They need information.
Well, I have you on here to give hope, so I'm going to just invite you to keep on giving hope and to tell us about some of the wonderful programs you're supporting. Is that a good segue for you?
That's an absolutely great segue. And so this is exactly what we're doing. I get the privilege of working with people all over the world and finding out what's working and what's not. I have spent time with people that have been extremely hurt by the current system. And I will tell you, I've spent time with people that have said, if it wasn't for this medication, I wouldn't be alive today. But I would also push back that some of those people are getting older, and now they're realizing, after being on medications for a while, that they're starting to have other symptoms. And they're starting to look at that data that says people die 25 years earlier when they're treated in the mental health system with the standard therapy of medications. So it's really a catch-22. And one of the things we're doing is having many conversations about this. We want to bring accurate data. So one of the things we're doing is we're looking over the last 30 years, the research that actually has been done and has been pushed under the table that people don't know about. And we're also funding current research that is non-biased, meaning it's not paid for by pharmaceutical companies or anybody that has a stake in the outcome of the research. And some of the research that we've had the opportunity to fund, some of those researchers like Marty Haro, et cetera, have come back to us and said the data is even worse than we thought about the effects of psychotropic medication and how damaging it is. I have been in touch with several authors that are interested in funding our work because their loved ones have completed suicide after being on antidepressants or antipsychotics over just a few weeks, and they are certain that this was a causal effect. So we're doing things like that. We've also have funders that have given grants to take a look at replicating the Hearing Voices Network. As you know, the phenomena of hearing voices, the public is very fearful that people might be dangerous that hear voices. And what I have found, I had a person who hears voices come to me and talk to me about this and challenged me to go to some of the hearing voices trainings. And since I'm not a voice hearer, I thought, okay, I'll try it. And what I found was a whole network and a whole system, kind of an underground system of people helping people to function well in society. I was blown away. And it's time to bring that network to light because I think that it can help a whole lot of people. That's one, the Hearing Voices Network. Another one is Open Dialogue. It's had good success in Western Lapland, so we have a funder that has helped us to start replicating it in the United States. It's starting to spread to Germany, the UK, Australia. Italy is interested. And basically, It's empathic therapy. It's taking whatever resources a person has that is early in their psychosis, bringing, psychiatrists, social workers, whoever the help team is, and having more than one 50-minute conversation one day a week, really getting to the root cause of the trauma of the mental health challenge and helping the person have hope and feel safety. So those are some of the programs that we're doing.
Let me just add that the open dialogue is, as I understand it, certainly as it developed in Finland, is it's a family oriented. You didn't mention that. So I wanted people to know they have a wonderful phrase that schizophrenia lies in between the family members. Like you could sit there and talk about it as a family issue. And it's a very, very powerful, and it draws very heavily on the family therapy tradition and also the psychotherapy of Bert Caron, my friend Bert, who wrote the first book on the psychotherapy of schizophrenia decades ago, went over there and helped influence them. So it's a psychotherapeutic approach involving the family. Is that accurate?
Yes. That is accurate, although I would add that sometimes if a person feels that family members are part of the problem, then it's gentle, slow psychiatry. There may be other friends or other members of the family that one can bring in to help the person feel safe. So usually you start with the family, but not always for those people out there that are worried about some family dynamics.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I didn't particularly see that in their writing and from Finland, but I've often wondered about that. And I think it makes a lot of sense that and sometimes you just need help individually separate from your family if in fact they're going to be repeating the old patterns that led to some of the problems. I think that's a very, very good thing that the way it's being done, I guess
the
in the sense under your funding and with your help, is to,
sure,
to make
absolutely.
It fluid.
The other thing, of course, as one well knows, in Western Lapland, there are a community that is very small and travels a lot less. So one of our questions in replicating this in the United States is we're fairly transitory. We don't often have extended family living in the same place. It's hard when there's not an open dialogue milieu in every county, in every city. People want to try open dialogue, but it's hard to get on a plane and go to another place and experience open dialogue because you don't have your wraparound supports in that particular location. So that very question, we're working with University of Massachusetts, Dr. Doug Ziadonis, Dr. Mary Olson, Dr. Chris Gordon, and others to really take a look at that piece and see what we need to do about looking at that piece and how it applies to the construct of open dialogue.
I think that's really, really good. My impression is that open dialogue works best when you have probably a younger person who's still in high school or even younger who's experiencing a breakdown. And the good news about that is usually there's going to be some family members in that person's life that won't have moved away already. And certainly if you're working with older people, you're going to run into that problem in our country so much so that family's not around.
So that is absolutely true. It's usually, younger people just getting out of what we consider childhood and going into young adulthood. But I will tell you, I was fortunate enough to watch a session when I was in Massachusetts a couple years ago of an older gentleman who had spent a good deal of his life married and decided to come out. And it was very, very traumatic, causing the family lots of angst, and he was becoming what one would consider psychotic. And they agreed to open dialogue as family, and he had his best friends there, as well as his wife. And it was a very gentle, it's not immediate, but he wanted so much for his family and himself to be healed and get rid of his suicidal ideations. And it really, really worked. So it does work with older people as well.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Absolutely. In my own practice, Gina, as you probably know, whenever I can, I work with families.
Yes.
I think that if you can have people who can be helped in loving each other, loving one another, and learning to communicate in ways that are always positive, as positive and helpful as they can be, and as caring and understanding as they can be, you can work miracles. When people are doing it together, in comparison to just one-to-one therapy, because you're really changing the whole context in which the people live, and you're affecting a whole group of people.
Yeah, I think the good news, Peter, is now finally, we've been at this for 5 years, and people says, "Oh, why does it take so long?" But we were able to have an article about this in the New York Times yesterday, which was great, because now I've had radio stations call me and want to interview me talking about this. And again, we're kind of the funding, community funding mechanism behind this. But, the good news is it's starting to catch on. And one of our board members, Dr. Sandra Steingard, was actually approached by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration, for the federal government, to come talk more about open dialogue. And they're actually starting to take a look at these things. Right now they're calling them alternatives, but I think soon they'll be in the mainstream, because these are the things that communities have employed for a lot of years before medications came along.
Well, it fits so well with the World Health Organization studies, which showed, despite what the original researchers wanted to show, that people do best in third world countries. They do best in countries that aren't heavily industrialized and westernized when they have a psychotic break. And there are probably two reasons. One, they're not exposed so much to psychiatric drugs and Western diagnoses and all that rigmarole and toxins and so on. And they have much stronger support systems of families who are often much more tolerant of hearing voices and aberration in their cultures, things we would call aberrations in our culture. So, I just hope everybody listening will hear the affirmation that people need each other. They need people and not pills. They need families, communities. They need organizations, support groups, therapists, if they can be helpful. And the answer is just not in the way of medical psychiatric interventions. It's just not the answer to human suffering.
And asking what's happened to you rather than what's wrong with you. That's so important. The hope and the kindness goes a long way. Absolutely.
It sounds to me like you're making some progress as an organization, that you're feeling more optimistic about surviving and funding some projects.
We are. What we've tried to do, a normal community foundation is, small geographically, and they'll fund whatever, people want to fund in their area. And they usually charge about, 10%. Well, we want to get the money out the door to the project. So our fees are quite a bit less than that. So we've had to raise money for our small infrastructure to pay people to do the work, along with raising money for the projects, and that's always a challenge. But our board is really keen that the majority, that 96% of the money get out the door at least to do the projects, and in some cases 100%. But this is going to take all of us. It really is going to take all of us, and we're starting to see the system change and become engaged, because I think that there's people that really care and really want to get back to that empathetic trying to figure out this together. And we owe a debt of gratitude to those psychiatrists, you included, and others who have been out in the forefront for decades and feeling not buoyed up. Well, we're here to help with that, because it is going to take all of us, and we're doing it. We're doing it. We want people to know that they can go on our website, www.mentalhealthexcellence.org. You can pick a fund, something that sounds interested that you want to donate to, or you can create your own. You can call us up and say, I'm very, very interested in this. Is there somebody that I can partner with? Of course, we have to make sure that it passes the straight face test and that if you want to do a research project, that it will meet protocol. But we're very, very interested in doing this together as a community, because we believe that the research and education that we now have knows that we need to work together. And I'm very excited about what's coming.
Let me try to explain how your organization works and see if it makes sense, because I think people need a little more clarity on what you're doing. This is what Gina most basically, what her Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care most basically and mechanically provides is that if you yourself can't go through the process of getting a 501c3, which is a difficult, hazardous process. I've been through it twice now in my life. It hadn't gotten any easier over the years. I think it gets more difficult with all the rules and regulations. In a sense, you can get a cover for a 501c3 through the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health, so that if you can present to them a project which makes sense, you can set your project up, and then you can go out and get donors who will get a tax deduction through the 501c3 of the foundation. Is that correct?
That is one of the things that we offer. Absolutely. That's called an incubator fund for somebody that wants to do a project and eventually create their own 501c3, but wants to get started today, right now. We can be that 501c3 umbrella, absolutely. For others that don't want to create that project or create that 501c3, but want to support somebody else's program, then they can donate. Or let's say they just have, maybe they have a little bit of money and they just want to give here and there. They can create their own donor advice fund to give money. We have several people that, don't want to do the work, but they just want to give here and there. So there's a number of opportunities that people have to do whatever they want.
And then you travel around raising funds for projects that your organization is particularly supporting. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. I also have a clinical background, so I've had to learn a lot about fundraising, and I've had some good teachers. So I do all of the above. I do run the organization. Of course, the staff that I have are really, really great at supporting me as I fundraise, and I talk to scientists and researchers and practitioners in the field to make sure that ideas that people have are viable. All of the above, whatever needs done.
It sounds like a absolutely wonderful job to have, but one requiring such toughness and strength and persistence and ability to accept rejection. Is that a fair description? I've never asked you that before. How do you do this?
That is good. Having had prior experience also as an elected official helps. But I was a county commissioner for 8 years in a small coastal county in Oregon. Mm-hmm. Peter, I think it's just also comes with age, having that tenaciousness. And, you're going to get told no sometimes, and then you just, go to the next door, or you get turned down by one person, you go somewhere else. And the group of us, the board, our funders, the people who have donor advised funds with us, the growing community of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care is so dedicated to this mission and knows that it really needs to happen at an organic level, that we're committed to seeing this through, because we believe we the people of Earth really need some hope and kindness and conversation around the practices in the field of psychiatry and mental health care.
Yes, we the people on Earth really do need more ability to relate in caring ways to each other. You bring me some hope, Gina. I'm still thinking it's all going to have to happen outside of organized medicine and psychiatry, but I think one of your purposes is to try to bring psychiatry along.
Absolutely, absolutely. Some people have said, "Oh, you're the anti-psychiatry group." That's the furthest from the truth. And in fact, people will look and see that I still have an appointment to the Department of Psychiatry at OHSU. And they'll kind of scratch their head. And I will say, we have psychiatrists on our board. We have psychiatrists that have donor advised funds. There are a lot of psychiatrists that want to help people and want to change the way business has been done, tweaking it. Some people still prescribe medication, but what they're understanding is that they need to be looking at prescribing less as they learn more and more about what these psychotropic medications actually do and do not do. That's a good process. So one of our funds, in fact, we just launched it as their own 501c3. So they opened us up as an incubator fund, and it's a continuing education program. And they have gathered many people around the world that have given lectures on what's going on, that they can get continuing medical education, so psychiatrists and primary care physicians that need to get medical education credits can take these classes online and learn what they didn't learn in med school. We also have classes for, you know, social workers, therapists, et cetera, so they can start really paying attention to publication bias and what today's research actually says about the use of medications. And I think it's very important. Also, people with lived experience. Those are the type of things we need to do. We need to not build up an us versus them. We, the people in the world, really need to have accurate information. And I would say have a conversation with your doctor. If you don't understand what's happening, get a second and get a third opinion. Educate yourself. Educate your family members. Don't be fed a line that you don't understand, and educate yourself.
Can you tell us more about the Hearing Voices movement? I'm trying to get in touch with some Hearing Voices people. I haven't had one on my show in a long time. In fact,
I can give you names of lots.
Yeah. Would you email me a couple of names? Or two or three.
I sure would.
People,
yeah,
for me to have on the show with their phone numbers, and maybe do it with a joint email to them, because
yep,
I really
yep,
want
yep.
to get these folks onto the show. Again, I've had some of the leaders on a couple of years ago, but not recently.
Absolutely. I will be glad to do that. So I have to tell you, we have a funder who has been very, very generous in wanting to help really further the Hearing Voices network in the United States. So we've been able to have 5 Training the Trainer classes for people who hear voices, and some of us that don't hear voices but want to support that movement for training. They have been phenomenal. We had a special training designed specifically for veterans that have come back from their service and hear voices, and I was lucky enough to be able to attend that training, and it absolutely blew me away at not only the help that I saw that it gave people there in the 3-day training that I attended, but also the hope and the professionalness of the trainers. And the trainers were all voice hearers that have been, I have a new respect for not only the Hearing Voices movement, but for people who have been ostracized and labeled as other and all sorts of labels. They have taken they have taken their experience at Hearing Voices and turned it into something that's not scary, that helps other people. And I had no idea personally that Hearing Voices is so prevalent. And I should know that. I've been a therapist and an administrator in the mental health field for a lot of years, but I'm really excited about the mental health Hearing Voices network. And Western Massachusetts Recovery Learning Center is a lead in providing peer support specialists and trainers that do phenomenal work. We also have a program out of Mount Holyoke that is researching that so we can have some data to help it be an evidence-based practice. So those are the type of things, because we want to go to insurance companies and government entities that want to do things differently. While I agree with you, Peter, that we probably need to do some things outside of our institutions, I have a premise that some of our government officials, they're just like us. Since I have been a government official, we can change the minds from the inside, and that's one of the other things that I do is help talk to and provide information to people that can change the way we do things, particularly in America.
One of the things my wife is fond of reminding me when I get a little discouraged is that my knocking so hard on the establishment has perhaps allowed people who simply aren't me to get more of a voice inside, because they can at least say, well, I'm not Peter Breggin.
Oh, Peter, you are just priceless. You know, the thing that I've learned in my time working in government is that, you know, quite often you need both ends of the spectrum. And it's the people in the middle that sometimes people don't like because they're seen as wishy-washy, but a lot of times it's the people in the middle that can help bring the two ends together. So you have to have all the forces pushing at each other. It's just the way it works. And sometimes it's exasperating. But we have to keep our shoulder to the wheel. And people ask me, you know, why are you doing this? What you know, what personal experience do you have, or what, you know? And I have to tell you, I first got my degree in theater and dance, and then somebody said, you'd make a really good therapist. So I went and I got my master's degree and as a counselor, and little did I know that when I really grew up and became an adult and had some real wisdom and experience, that I would have a number of family members and I just that had mental health challenges and have mental health challenges, and I feel really blessed that I was given the opportunity to have all these experiences in the mental health field before I needed them personally as a family member.
Yes, life is difficult for people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, absolutely.
Like one of the simplest and greatest truths of all time is life is difficult. And that also yeah. helps me think about that, you know, drugs aren't the answer. Life's always been difficult. What have human beings evolved to help us with the difficulties of life? And certainly community and family has always been the heart of supporting individuals, even while it also, unfortunately, is often the heart of harming people. It's complicated out there.
It's very, very complicated, and that's why it's so important to underscore the one size doesn't fit all. There's not a one magic bullet, or there's not one thing to do. So, you know, for instance, another fund that we have is a nutrition fund. We have a researcher out of Canada and a researcher out of New Zealand that have found that some people, not all, but some people that experience, you know, maybe depression or other things, that maybe they do have a nutritional deficiency. Now, that doesn't apply to everyone, but they have some research that takes a look at, you know, making sure that people have the micronutrients that they need. So if somebody thinks that, you know, that trauma-informed care or a trauma doesn't account for their depression, perhaps, you know, there might be a nutritional component So they're researching that and taking a look at micronutrients. You know, you may be low in a particular micronutrient, but you're not low in Seroquel or another drug. Does that make sense?
Well, it's not something I particularly know any evidence for, and it's not my clinical experience, but I also think it's really great that you're having a broad umbrella that is going to embrace, you know, a variety of different fields. I tend to think that the vast majority of the folks who are suffering in this world are suffering from emotional, psychological issues and or more gross nutritional issues. Like, I mean, they're eating very badly and they're they're getting hypoglycemic and they're getting weak and they're not growing in a healthy way. So I'd be more in in the line of folks who are looking at what are the best nutritional approaches for human beings in general. And I have some good friends who do work in that area you know, how should human beings be eating? You know, should we be eating more meat or less meat? Should we be eating wheat-free, gluten-free diets? Because until 10,000 years ago, we didn't have them. So we didn't evolve very well to eat those kinds of things. So I'm more in favor of looking at the larger nutritional issues than the micronutrients, which just sounds to me a little bit too much like there's something the matter with your particular neurotransmitter or something like that, which is not where I go. But hey, I am happy to have you supporting these.
It may be. We have a funder, several funders who want to fund that, and it's you know, plausible, feasible. So we'll take a look at that. I did want to say that I also have a researcher out of Johns Hopkins. He's not funded yet, but he has come to me and said that over his 35 years plus of work with people diagnosed with schizophrenia, he believes that he can show that at least 40% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia actually have a gluten intolerance. And I've talked to several researchers, some that say, oh, that's bunk, and some say, I think he has a point there. So my question is, should that be funded to find out whether it makes sense or not? Those are the type of things, the questions that we, you know, wrestle with, so that we take a look at all realms of mental health challenge. But, Peter, I tend to go where you go as well, that a lot of mental health challenges are trauma-based.
You mentioned 35 years of experience, and I've had a realization in the last couple of weeks that was never really quite, hadn't been quite so clear to me. It's been growing. You know, I started working when I was 18 years old in this field intensely at Harvard, spending more time on the wards of Metropolitan State Hospital for many of those years, and also traveling and lecturing on volunteers and starting a book on volunteers, that I've now been active in the field for 62 years, that I've actually seen state hospitals before the drugs came in 1954, and saw insulin coma in 1954, and that for an ordinary psychiatrist who had 12 years of training would have to be not 80 like I am, but in his 90s to have this breadth of experience, I may be one of the oldest practicing psychiatrists with the longest longevity of experience of spanning 62 years. Do you follow what I'm saying? It's coming out a little
twisted. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I've only had 36 years of experience in this field. You've doubled my experience. I think we've got to pay attention to that. We have to pay attention.
I'm trying to emphasize it as I'm thinking about this. I'm working on a new book. I've been struggling to find my voice for a new book. And And I realized that one of the things that now has happened is that with me being healthy at age 80 and active at age 80 and doing all the things, really pretty much all the things I ever did, and doing some of them better than I ever did, I think, that, my gosh, I've got to give people a sense of what I see as that arc of psychiatry from the heyday of the state mental hospital, insulin coma, lobotomy. I knew men. One of my mentors was a lobotomist of the program. I saw lobotomy patients. I'm trying to just sort of give people a sense of what this whole arc of psychiatry is about. Just something that was on my mind I thought I'd share with you. We've got about 4 minutes left. Yeah. What, Gina?
That would be a real gift to the world. It really would. I hope you do that, Peter. I really do.
Well, I'm trying to do it without making it an autobiography at all, but making it rather a biography of psychiatry and what I've seen. It's fun to just talk about it for 2 minutes. Now, we've got about 4 minutes left. So, 2 minutes left, I'm being told. I'm behind time. Listen, this is, my folks, this is Gina Nickel. You don't get any better than this. Nickel, president and CEO of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. Gina, some summing up. Let me invite you to do some summing up on what you think about where your experience is taking you and your foundation.
Well, where my experience is taking me is, I know that we all, and all the listeners out there, we have to work together. And kindness, hope, putting our best ideas together, working with professionals, it's going to take all of us. So I would invite you to come to our website. Please send us your thoughts. Let's do this together. And thank you so much, Peter, for having me on your show. This is really important work.
Yeah, I really hope people will send this particular show around and let folks know that there really is a movement. And I think that you're spearheading that movement. Thanks again
for
being on the show.
Thank you, Peter.